Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. My guest this hour considers himself part of the generation of Europeans who saw Americans as their saviors. He was 8 years old when American GIs arrived in his homeland, England, and he welcomed the opportunity as a young man to come to the U.S. to work. But now, in a new book, Godfrey Hodgson writes critically about some of the most cherished beliefs of many Americans, that their nation is unlike any other existing today or that have come before it. His new book is titled The Myth of American Exceptionalism. Godfrey Hodgson joins me in this studio. I hope you will join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Godfrey Hodgson is Associate Fellow at the Rothermere American Institute at Oxford University. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you
here. Good morning, Diane.
First of all, for our audience and for me, define what you mean by American exceptionalism.
Well, I take it to mean an idea, which is the idea that the United States is not just different from other countries, but is morally superior to other countries. Now, I know a lot of people wouldn't accept that, but I think that is a constant theme in American history. And I think that a lot of Americans, without even realizing it, are socialized to believe that in school and through all kinds of osmosis, through media and what they read,
that
the history.
This country is the greatest in the world.
Yes, but in a moral, specifically moral sense. And I think in recent years, that has also translated into the idea that the United States has a high destiny to export its ideals and its beliefs. Some would say militarily, others would say only culturally. That, I suppose, is quite a major theme in American foreign policy at this moment. But in any case, I think most Americans do believe that their country is morally different, morally superior, and has a historical destiny.
How long do you think that idea or ideal has existed in the minds of Americans?
Well, I think it has its origins long before the American Revolution, because I think that the original Puritan settlers had inherited from British and European Protestantism a certain sense of being special and of having a special destiny. The whole idea of the pilgrim, that's in the back of the mind of the people who William Bradford subsequently called. They didn't call themselves pilgrims, but he called them pilgrims, and he was one of their leaders. But in the back of their mind was the memory, of course, of John Bunyan's poem about being a pilgrim. And I think that 17th century European Protestants did feel that they had a religious duty and a religious destiny. And I think that filtered through into the ideals of the early republic.
You say in the book that one way in which this has developed is that Americans have ignored the interdependence of America and Europe, and also the fact that Europe, in the course of the 19th century, was changing as fast, if not in precisely the same ways as the United States.
Yeah, that's right. First of all, I believe from the beginning, the United States was very much part of great historical movements. It was founded in part as a result of the Reformation. It was influenced by the great conflict between Britain and France, which was really a conflict between Protestant countries and Catholic countries. It was influenced by the African slave trade, by the expansion of Europe, by the development of capitalism. All of these things happened in many places, particularly in Western Europe and in North America. And I think that Americans have been, on the whole, been brought up to believe that their experience was more exceptional than it actually was.
But, you know, if you take Russia, if you take China, if you take Europe, doesn't every nation, doesn't England consider itself exceptional?
Absolutely. And indeed, I say somewhere in the book, you know, it's an endless list, but certainly French, the Spanish, the Germans, the British, the Japanese, the Chinese, and you can go on. All of these nations considered that they had a very special quality, that they had the French called it a civilizing mission, and most of them had a certain universalist belief. They believed that their ideas were better and more, their beliefs were valid. And they, over history, each of these groups and many others have tried to impose, or at the very least, to sell their ideas. I think that was wrong then, wrong going on absurd, and I still think it's a mistake and a danger for the United States now.
Godfrey Hodgson, his new book is titled "The Myth of American Exceptionalism." Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You know, it's one thing for a member of a family to criticize from within about that family. It's quite another thing for someone outside the family to begin criticizing that family. You, as something of an outsider, are criticizing what's happening here in this country. I wonder if you're going to get some kickback on that.
Oh, I'm expecting to be tarred and feathered, absolutely. But I would point out that Americans have hardly been backward in criticizing other people.
This is true, too. But does not being American affect your perspective?
I'm sure it does. On the other hand, I've spent a great deal of my life here. I often tell people that I've worked in 48 of the 50 states, which I have. I've taught in great American universities. I spent several years of my life in the newsroom of the Washington Post. So I consider myself to be only half an outsider.
Half an outsider with the opportunity to view what's happening in this country.
Yes. And I think, you see, I don't think exceptionalism is necessarily a bad thing. I think, on the contrary, in many ways, it's inspired high standards in public life, high standards of behavior. People feel that they have to live up to an ideal. I think that's a positive thing.
But you also talk about the dangers.
I do. And one of the dangers, the one way I put it very simply, that I just don't think it's good for either a nation or an individual to believe things that are not entirely true.
Such as?
Well, for example, I mean, there are a lot of the sort of classic cherished beliefs of American exceptionalism, which are not entirely true. I go through several of them. Let's start with that vision so precious to Ronald Reagan of the city upon a hill. Now, that speech, curiously enough, we have no evidence of it at all from the time. We don't know where it was made. It was certainly not made in the United States, certainly not made, as President Reagan said, on a ship tossing on the Atlantic. It was made, in fact, in the city of Southampton in England by a man who was an Englishman, who repeatedly said he was an Englishman, about 125 years before there was such a thing as an American consciousness. And as for the city upon a hill being a model to other nations, it was actually intended to be a model to other British colonies, which were, in effect, mostly in Ireland. So there's a lot of historical, of ahistorical belief there. People have cherished ideas which are simply not true.
But isn't there a strength to be found in believing that this nation, having been built as it was by patriots who believed in a certain kind of freedom, and certainly religious freedom for one, and fought for it and continue to fight for freedom, at least in this country, seems to me that you're arguing that what's wrong with that is trying to export it.
No, I believe that it's important to look at history in a very objective way. And for example, it's true that the original settlers in New England believed in religious freedom, especially for themselves. It's not true that they tolerated religious freedom for others.
The myth of American exceptionalism. Godfrey Hodgson is the author. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Godfrey Hodgson is Associate Fellow at the Rother American Institute at the University of Oxford. He has written a book titled The Myth of American Exceptionalism. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Godfrey Hodgson, just before the break, we were beginning to talk about what's wrong with this country feeling as though it is an exceptional country. What are the negative impacts? What are the damages that may have been done?
Yeah, I think exceptionalism can be a positive thing. I think many of the great men of American history have been exceptionalists. It's true, for example, of Thomas Jefferson or of Franklin Roosevelt. In fact, it's so much part of the political culture in the United States that it would actually be quite hard to run successfully for office unless you were, to some extent, an exceptionalist. What's wrong with it? Well, two things. One is that I think it misleads people about the reality of American history and also about the reality of America's situation in the world. I'll give you a tiny example. opened the Washington Post today. There's a story about how China has overtaken Germany as the third largest economy in the world, which is an interesting fact. I think most people would have been surprised that China wasn't already bigger, given that the population of China is some 20 times larger than that of Germany. That's mental arithmetic. I can't do the sum in my head. But the point I'm making is that for a very long time now, the European Union has been the biggest economy in the world. That's never, ever mentioned in the United States. That's a tiny example of the way that Americans tend to be given a picture of their situation in relation to the rest of the world, which is not altogether accurate. And I'll give you another example, which is the phrase, deeply beloved phrase, a lone superpower. Now, sometime in the 1980s, late 80s, early 1990s, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, people started talking about the United States as a lone superpower. Now, the word lone is very interesting because it's a poetic, archaic word. The ordinary thing, if one wanted to say that the United States was the only superpower, one would say the only superpower. The moment you say lone, you conjure up, in my mind, Henry Kissinger being teased by an Italian journalist called Oriana Fallaci into admitting that he saw himself as the Lone Ranger. So somehow in this phrase, endlessly repeated, the lone superpower, there's an echo of a TV program from the 1950s. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a discourse here which is not quite straight.
But at the same time, militarily speaking, would you not agree that the United States is indeed the lone superpower?
Well, I'd say the only superpower, of course. The United States spends more on defense than all the rest of the countries in the world put together. And if you want to say that's a good thing, I mean, that's fine. But another thing is that people talk about defense. Military expenditure in the United States is always called defense expenditure, as though by definition what we spend on the military is always defense. Well, many people in the world wouldn't agree with that. There's also a sense in which I think the United States is congratulating itself on triumphantly winning a contest which nobody else has been involved in my lifetime, or the second half of my lifetime. It's rather as if the United States was as if there'd been a kind of contest between the great powers of 1914, the British, the Russians, the Germans, the French, and the United States joins in, and there we are, we've beaten them all. We're in the final, and now we're the champions. But everybody else has actually stopped playing. And I think this is where I think one shifts from the essentially benign national pride and patriotism of the historic exceptionalism into something which becomes a little bit more dangerous.
You were talking about a kind of hubris that's at work.
Absolutely. That's a word I've used, and I think it's very hard to get away from the fact that at least some people in American public life are rather consistently guilty of hubris. Yeah.
Now, are you talking primarily about, say, the last 20, 30, 40 years? Did we come out of the Second World War having defeated Germany, having dropped a bomb on Japan, having sent millions of dollars and assistance to Europe to rebuild it? Did we come out of that with hubris, or did we come out of that with pride?
I think that the United States, to a remarkable extent, was free from hubris in those years when, ironically, it genuinely was the most powerful country in the world, unchallenged. In recent years, the United States has been more challenged in a number of ways. And one of the chapters in my book is a rather disagreeable chapter about negative exceptionalism. The fact is, the United States, although most Americans imagine, for example, that American medicine was by far the best in the world, in terms of results, the United States comes somewhere in the 20s in comparative tables about medicine. The same is true about education, about public health. that there are a number of respects in which Americans are brought up to believe that they are easily first, when actually, in some ways, they're struggling to be in the top 20.
Where do you believe this sort of skewed sense of ourselves began?
Well, I was a reporter in Washington in the 1960s, and I wrote a book about the 1968 election. And that seems to me that that was the first turning point. That was the end of an essentially benign period of American history in which great progress was being made in a great many ways for ordinary people, ordinary white people and ordinary black people. And from 1968 on, there was a kind of a break. The economy suddenly wasn't in quite such good shape. There was more sense of competition with foreign nations. There was a good deal of anger in American politics. And then along came that extraordinary figure, Ronald Reagan, who I had the privilege to meet several times and to interview at great length once. And he, somebody who in many ways I admire, nevertheless, I felt that many of the things that went wrong date from the Reagan administration. And among them, I think, is deregulation of business, which has led straight to the troubles we're all in now, whether it's deregulation of banking, deregulation of airlines, deregulation of media. I just don't think it was as good an idea as he thought. I think his idea that government was not part of the solution but part of the problem was plain wrong and very dangerous. So I do think things began to go wrong there. But I'm not making a sort of party political point. I do think that a number of things began to go wrong. And then something very interesting happened. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, then we have the lone superpower. And suddenly, two things happen. One is that people in the United States feel they don't need to be nice to allies anymore and are increasingly sort of dismissive of and contemptuous of allies. And secondly, the allies themselves no longer feel they need to be defended by the United States. The United States wants to go on defending them, but they don't particularly feel that they need to be defended. So that in the foreign policy field, that's another break.
You know, it's interesting because you are talking about the role of the United States from on high and then how that filters down to ordinary Americans. And the question I would have for you is the myth of American exceptionalism really in the minds of politicians rather than in the minds of ordinary people like you and me?
I think a bit of both is the quick answer. I mean, I think it is in the minds of politicians, and that's where you get dangerous and, wrong policies. But I think it wouldn't be there if it wasn't that a great many Americans have been brought up to believe in the exception. And I think there's a reason. I think it's connected with one of the great historical facts about the United States, which is not wholly exceptional, and that is the great historical fact of migration. That when a family or an individual packs up and takes the really quite frightening and dangerous decision to go and move to a strange country, different language, then you have an enormous investment, emotional investment, in believing that that was the right thing to do. One of the most peculiar facts of American history, which again is not, I stumbled on after years of studying American history, which is that a third of all the people who migrated to the United States between 1840 and 1920 went home again. And by the way, it turns out that since 1965, when a new immigration environment was created, almost the same is true. 30%, not 33%.
Turn around, go back
home.
Yes,
but that, of course, many of them always meant to do that. Many of them, you know, life changed in some unpredictable way. But also, of course, if a third of the migrants went home, how many didn't manage to scratch the fare together or died before they could get back? So 33 is probably closer to being a minimum percentage.
And how do you interpret that?
I think basically that life in the United States was not as golden and wonderful.
Or more difficult.
It was more difficult than people expected.
Yeah.
And it was certainly more difficult, this is interesting, than people abroad thought. I think most people around the world for over 100 years had the idea that life in the United States was much easier and pleasanter and free from difficulty than it actually turned out to be.
But surely those coming from developing nations where basic resources were scarce would find that life here in this country was easier.
Of course, tens of millions of people did find it easier, but it's not been quite
as easy
as I think both Americans historically have believed and other people have believed.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now.
Right.
First, I'd like to read to you an email from Randy in Live Oak, Texas, who says, let's take a look at the recent election as an attempt to validate America's exceptionalism. Where in any time in the world has the son of an immigrant become its leader by peaceful methods? Only in America.
I wonder if that's really true. I can't immediately think of an example, but there are plenty of people who have risen to high political office in Western Europe who came from very impoverished backgrounds.
But the leader.
Yeah. I mean, most recent British prime ministers have come from very humble backgrounds. Margaret Thatcher did. Edward Heath did.
But she wasn't an immigrant.
No, because then, when they were growing up, there weren't many immigrants. There now are very many. Mm. I don't think it's entirely impossible that, well, after all, the president of France is an immigrant's child. His family come from Hungary.
Indeed. All right, let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Professor Hodgson. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Fascinating discussion, and I do very much agree with the premise of the book, which I now have to go buy. But I have a couple quick questions for the professor.
Sure.
And that is that, do you think that the geographic isolation of the U.S. is a contributing factor to the exceptionalism in the minds of Americans, and will it continue to be so in the future? And second question, and I'll take your comments off the air, is that how do we get away from the mind sink of American exceptionalism and the hubris and the arrogance that couples that? Thank you very much, and I'll listen off the air.
Thanks for calling.
Well, I think that the geographical isolation is a factor, bound to be. I also think the sheer size of the country is a factor, that it's very easy when you're in, I don't know, I mean, places where I've spent time, Boulder, Colorado, for example, or in Gary, Indiana, or Texas, it is easy not to think the rest of the world matters, and not even really to be particularly aware in any detail of what it's like. I think size is important. I think until comparatively recently, the United States was self-sufficient. And that was important. In 1940, the United States exported 2/3 of all the oil and gas in the world. It now imports more than 2/3 of its own requirements. So the ending of self-sufficiency is important. The United States is not self-sufficient. It may be a lone superpower. It may be by far the most powerful country militarily, but but two-thirds of the national debt is owned abroad, some in China, some in Japan, some in Europe. The United States is dependent on the outside world for markets. It's dependent on the outside world, actually, for workers and people. Old stock Americans, like Western Europeans, are not reproducing themselves.
Do you think, addressing her second question, how do we get away from this kind of hubris, doesn't it begin at the top?
I think it begins at the top, but I think it also, if you talk about what to do about it, I think one of the things that one could do about it is to look at college and school textbooks. I was quite astonished, actually. I decided halfway through writing this book, I ought to think about that. So I got out some standard textbooks, including some by some very respected and distinguished historians. And they all start by saying, basically, this book is going to tell you why we're so different from everybody else.
The Myth of American Exceptionalism. Godfrey Hodgson is my guest. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by this and other NPR stations, by WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to ensure that all children have access to high-quality, voluntary pre-kindergarten at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the future of cars and the auto industry. Journalist Paul Eisenstein joins us from the Detroit Auto Show. He's been reporting on cars for 30 years. And we talk with Daniel Sperling, co-author of 2 Billion Cars, Driving Toward Sustainability. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. It's time to go back to the phones, 800-433-8850. First, now let's go to Burlington, North Carolina. Good morning, Greg. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Just a quick comment, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The two terms, hubris and unilateralism, has been used a lot lately in America, especially within the last 8 years. Getting back to the word unilateralism, there's a term in American jargon that really bothers me and bothers probably a lot of people around the country and around the rest of the world, and that is the term, God bless America. It's almost like some Americans feel that Americans only have a unilateral relationship with God. And I always like to say to people, God bless America and the rest of the world as well. That's all I want to say.
Thanks for calling, Godfrey.
That's nice. I agree with that. I have to say we all involve the deity in our patriotic beliefs. We say God save the Queen, and I also find that slightly strange. But I do think there was something I was going to say. One of the things is that the content of exceptionalism has changed. It used to be, for example, that the founding fathers were not, on the whole, religious men. They were mostly either skeptics or deists or agnostics. And now I think religion, for many Americans, is seen as an essential part of the American belief system. But it wasn't always. Similarly, nowadays, I think military patriotism is very important. But actually, historically, Americans saw themselves as a uniquely civilian people. They had been successful in their wars. They had fought the first and greatest and most destructive of modern wars in the Civil War. But Americans were profoundly attached to the idea that theirs was a civilian society. They were against militarism. So, in the period of Woodrow Wilson, I wrote a biography of Woodrow Wilson's friend, Colonel House, and he was always saying, unlike those Europeans, we're not interested in war and navalism or militarism. They were always denouncing. Nowadays, you don't hear so many people in American politics denouncing militarism or navalism.
Here is an email from Kelly in St. Louis to Godfrey Hodgson. How has the Bush presidency been shaped, do you believe, by the myth of American exceptionalism, and how will this belief affect his legacy?
Well, I think it's quite clear that his whole attitude to the world and his whole style and his policies were exceptionalist. Bring them on, you know. Mission accomplished. I think it's been extremely damaging, both for American interests and also for America's reputation. I hope, and the world hopes, that this is going to change quite a lot quite soon. And that's one of the reasons why I'm optimistic. But I do think it's going to be quite hard to persuade Americans in general that theirs is not a uniquely democratic, a uniquely fair, a uniquely decent society. And I think it's never a very good idea to spend a lot of time telling other people that you're more decent than they are.
But, you know, if you turn on conservative talk radio hosts in the United States,
yeah,
you do hear that again and again, that America is the greatest nation in the world. Why should we pay attention to what this country says or
sure,
that country says? And there are millions of adherents, not just listeners, but adherents to those views.
There certainly are. Absolutely. I remember when I was in graduate school in the United States, there was a guy down the hall who was, would engage me in conversation about world politics, and his mantra was, "We don't have to be nice to anyone." And I think there are a lot of Americans feel that way, but I don't agree with them. I think it would be a good idea to be, as Americans always historically were until quite recently. I mean, the way in which the United States did not take advantage of its great power in the 40 years after World War II was one of the things that made us love the United States.
All right, let's go to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Joe. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Professor, you've got to be the most condescending guest ever on this show. I listen to this show every day. I'm not a conservative. But I've been taking issue with a lot that you've said, but for the sake of time, I'll just go back to something recently that you mentioned about moral behavior. I mean, I've lived all over the world. I can take my son to a football match, and his friend can be a supporter of another football team, and there won't be a riot afterwards. After 9/11, how many mosques in this country were burned? None. In 96, during the Brixton riots in Britain, in your civilized society, there were immigrant houses burned to the ground. And it's still, NPR's had a series on the way immigrants are treated in civilized countries like France, Germany, and Italy. And they still look to us to come here because they won't be treated that way. That was my issue, Diane. I'll let it go from there. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, I'm sorry if I sounded condescending. I don't quite know in what respect I'm being condescending. I'm certainly, no part of my intention in writing this book is to say that any other country is better in any particular respect. I'm just saying that just as I dislike hubris in politicians in my own country, so I think I should be allowed to say that I dislike it when I see it in a country which has so much influence on the whole world.
Here's an email from Joseph in New Jersey who says, please identify the kinds of actions America has taken that were based on or motivated by the concept of American exceptionalism. Is war the natural consequence when two countries feel exceptional about a common issue?
Well, I'm not quite sure what that last sentence means, but I mean, I think, as I've been saying, exceptionalism is not necessarily a bad thing if it is something which motivates politicians and people to set themselves high standards, as I think Americans over their history have done. I think if it motivates them to interfere aggressively and militarily in other countries, then I'm not so keen on it.
All right, let's go to Hollywood, Florida. Good morning, Mike.
How you doing, Diane? I'm so excited to be on your show today.
Thank you.
I just had a few comments about previous comments that were made. I believe Alberto Fujimori in Peru, I'm not sure if he was an immigrant or the son of an immigrant, and also about Barack Obama. I believe he was a millionaire, and just like about everybody else who runs for the president, you have to be very wealthy just in order to participate in something like that. But I just wanted to mention a few of the shortcomings of this country, like the absolute disintegration of the public educational system, and some of the just not proper actions of our government that they execute on their own citizens, like the domestic spy program and the MK Ultra project, and just how they police the world.
All right. Thanks for calling. Surely these charges of torture, of surveillance, that kind of thing has not helped our image abroad, Godfrey. But how would you say that affects our attitudes about ourselves?
Well, I think there's an enormous national feeling and mood that it's time to make sure that such things never happen again. It is the case. The United States has not been so different from other people in the past. You know, when the first revelations were made of torture or something indistinguishable from torture in American-run prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan, elsewhere, a common theme was, we Americans never do that kind of thing. But in fact, the third degree was common, was in use in police stations all over the United States until comparatively recently. America's never been a non-violent society. I think, like other civilized societies, torture and violence have been controlled by the law. And I think part of the problem here may have been the feeling that somehow foreigners were collectively guilty for the atrocities of 9/11 and therefore didn't deserve to be treated properly. I think that's the only psychological explanation I can think of.
All right, let's go to Sag Harbor, New York. Good morning, Tony.
I wanted to say that the professor has written a book which seems, defensible if somewhat narrow, but I just wanted to point out that as a 43-year-old American who has been living in somewhat of a dark ages with respect to my political beliefs, the moment at this moment the professor chooses a really inopportune time to release a book, this is truly the moment. I've been accused of not being a patriot by my government for the last 8 years and really for the last 30 years. And I couldn't be more proud of America in this time and in this place. And I just think it's unfortunate for the professor that he didn't come out with this book about 10 years ago. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Well, maybe I did get the timing wrong. It takes one a certain amount of time to research and write a book, and I'm as happy as everybody, as many other people are, about the president-elect. But I don't think it really affects the argument that I was making very much.
Which is that we've got to be careful.
Yeah.
We've got to be thoughtful. We've got to be careful about how we view ourselves as a country and how we behave towards others.
Yeah, I mean, I went out of my way at great length to say how much I love America and how much that's why I've spent so much of my life studying it and being here and so on. But the last sentence of the first chapter refers to the many dangers of self-praise. And that actually was the phrase I wanted to use as a title, but my publishers thought it was a bit too obscure. But I think that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the dangers of self-praise.
How has capitalism fit into this sense of our exceptionalism?
Well, that's interesting. Capitalism was hardly invented in the United States. There's a fair amount of evidence it was going on in the river valleys of Western Asia 4,000 years ago. And if you want to see markets in operation, you could do worse than go and talk to the women who run markets in Nigeria. There's nothing exclusively American about capitalism. It's true that the United States appears to want to export its own particular stage of capitalism, this highly deregulated finance capitalism, and that has been if that is an error, it's certainly been rather swiftly punished.
Do you think?
I certainly do. I mean, you can't open a newspaper without some icon of American business collapsing.
But didn't every nation participate in that?
I think the idea of deregulating, of maximizing the deregulation of business, was essentially an American idea. It started in the United States. Indeed, it's often referred to as the Washington Consensus.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Bowling Green, Ohio, and to Todd. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. First, I'd like to agree with your gentleman in most respects of what he's saying. The thing that's just kind of stunned me, and it's been reiterated several times by several other callers, is how he can view this as a non-party political issue, especially when he first inferenced the Reagan administration and their policies. And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. Are you looking specifically at the Bush years indicting Republicans, starting with Ronald Reagan?
Well, first of all, having been a reporter in the United States for 4 decades, I've always tried not to be specifically partisan. It's part of one's job not to be. I have to admit that I'm more sympathetic to and have been more sympathetic to Democratic politicians and policies all of my working life. But that's, I'm not specifically saying that exceptionalism is a Republican policy, because I think you could say that John F. Kennedy was an exceptionalist. I think Martin Luther King was an exceptionalist. I've just finished writing a biography of King, who I'm proud to say I knew. And he certainly often said and certainly believed that the United States was in many ways a morally exceptional country. I'm not saying this is a single-party political
belief. But you are suggesting that word morally has somehow been subjected to question over the last 20 years.
Yeah, I think I am saying that. And I think I'm saying that that exceptionalism becomes dangerous at the point where one attempts to impose more or less forcibly one's belief system on other people. And I end the book, which is pretty nasty of me, I suppose, by a reference to an event in the history of Athens. Now, Athens was the champion of democracy against the Persian Empire, Athens was the birthplace of democracy, and yet in the course of its war with Sparta, the Athenians wanted to control an island which was independent, and they ended up by offering the people of this island the choice that they either surrendered or would be massacred. And the Athenians, champions of democracy, actually massacred. They killed all the men and they sold the women and children into slavery. And that, I think most historians believe, is the moment where Athens ceased to be a democracy. And I'm saying that if you export violence around the world, watch out or it'll come home.
The myth of American exceptionalism. Godfrey Hodgson is the author. Thank you so much for a fascinating discussion. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.